Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today I'm talking to Dr. Yana Steinova, who is the author of the book Sonorous Worlds, Musical Enchantment in Venezuela, published by the University of Michigan Press. Dr. Steinova, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming to talk about your book. And so your book is an ethnography of El Sistema, which is the largest, which is a large-scale classical music education program in Venezuela. So how did you come to write this book? And can you tell us about yourself, your background, and what sparked your interest in classical music in Venezuela?
Thank you for this question. So the roots of my inspiration for writing this book lie in my childhood. I was born in Bulgaria on the eve of the revolutions that brought about the fall of communism in Eastern Europe. And one of my earliest memories is of standing on the balcony of my childhood home and looking over the usually busy boulevard that was suddenly overflowing with thousands of people protesting the communist regime. And what struck me about these protests was the artistic practice that defined them in some way. So I remember people pushing a piano down the street and somebody playing the music, the song Winds of Change by the Scorpions. And this early childhood memory of a revolution, of rebellion against a repressive government, and my own life that was marked by this political transition was one of the points of inspiration for doing fieldwork in Venezuela, a country that also defined itself as socialist. I also played the piano throughout my childhood and to this day, the hour of playing music every day structured my life. It transformed how I experienced my everyday. And when I was 11, I also started playing the flute. So classical music was an important part of my life. And though I did not become a professional musician, my fascination and passion for music remained. So then years later, when I was a college student at Mount Holyoke and I did study abroad in Chile, I became interested in the place of poetry during the Chilean dictatorship and in the transition to democracy. In Chile, I found another big political transition from the Pinochet dictatorship to democracy in the country that took place roughly around the same time that the big political transition in Bulgaria took place. So I met people of my own generation whose lives were similarly marked by political change. And as I was doing research on poetry, I came to see how the writing and sharing of poems allowed people to form communities of solidarity and and shared support in a time of brutal censorship and violence. At the time, I was not as interested in doing a literary analysis of the poems, but rather to talk to people, both the poets who wrote the poems, but also the people for whom these poems were important. So without realizing it at the time, I was already doing anthropological research through my interviews. I then began graduate school in anthropology, still thinking about doing research with Venezuelan, with Chilean poets. But in my first year of the graduate program, I heard about this classical music program in Venezuela called El Sistema, which brings music to young people on the urban margins. And I was immediately fascinated by this idea, the idea of challenging the elitist status of classical music through the practice at the urban margins, and my interest in artistic practice and political change in Latin America, which was born in Chile, became transposed to Venezuela. And so I was overcome by an uncharacteristic for me certainty, and I got on a plane to Venezuela to study this music program, which became the object of my dissertation research and subsequently the book that I'm talking about today.
That's so interesting. I love that, how you described it as this uncharacteristic certainty, and you got on the plane and off you went. That's really moving. And so I guess then the next question, I guess, is how can you orient us to the classical education program that you just talked about, El Sistema in Venezuela, and you just said it brings classical music to youth on the urban margins. And so, can you tell us about that? What is it? How does it work? How is it organized? And in the book, you focus really kind of on the musicians of El Sistema. And so, I wondered how you came to that idea to focus on sort of just the musicians, and not necessarily as sort of an ethnography of El Sistema as a larger organization.
Yes, thanks for this question. El Sistema is a Venezuelan initiative that brings free classical music and instruments to what is now over a million young people all over the country. And it was formed in 1975 by economist and musician José Antonio Abreu, a prominent political figure in Venezuelan life at the time. He had this vision for bringing classical music to a wider audience and found strategic ways of gaining state support from the oil-rich Venezuelan state to support his vision. What characterizes El Sistema is that it survived seven different changes in government from 1975 to this very day, and these governments have been of radically opposing political convictions, which gives or demonstrates the institution's resilience in the face of political change. What characterizes the practice of music within El Sistema is that it is almost exclusively collective, which is unusual for classical music practice. So almost all of the classes take place in groups, and while the teacher is the one doing most of the pedagogical work, it is also a tradition within El Sistema that each student, slightly more advanced student, teaches the younger beginning students how to play an instrument. So there is a kind of group work at several levels taking place. Rehearsals are almost exclusively collective as well, which again is unusual. Most classical music practice takes in North in North America and Europe takes place in solitary confinement. People come together for the most part as an orchestra for a couple of rehearsals before the main orchestra performance. In Venezuela, these orchestra rehearsals are, as I say, almost exclusively collective, which contributes to the community building, both within the space of music and beyond. So there, El Sistema is the headquarters are located in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela. A seven-story state-of-the-art building brings together the four top orchestras that rehearse and perform there, gathering the best musicians from the program. The headquarters is also a site where international conductors and musicians, world renowned, visit Venezuela in order to conduct these orchestras. But beyond the headquarters of El Sistema, there are 423 smaller music schools scattered all over the country. And I visited quite a few of them. And most of them are located in the so-called barrios, which are working class neighborhoods in Venezuela that are lacking in public infrastructure, with less access to education, medical services, and also are affected by everyday gang violence. So as in other cities in Latin America, in Venezuela, in the Venezuelan barrios, there are usually several gangs vying for control over drugs and territory, and their activity shapes the lives of all residents in the community. So it is for that reason that many parents and young musicians are interested in participating in El Sistema, an institution that gives structure and systematic education to young people, and also provides them opportunities for the future that are perhaps foreclosed by the structural forces that shape their lives. So I decided to study not the institution itself, but rather the musicians and specific musicians within the institution, because I realized that the institution is so enormous that I could not encompass its entirety. The emphasis of my work is on qualitative, in-depth ethnographic research with musicians, rather than a qualitative, broad stroke research with as many people as I can interview. So I realized that I didn't want to try to pass a verdict on the success or failure of this musical experiment, or to try to give an account of the median El Sistema musician. Rather, I became fascinated with the stories about what music meant to the lives of the people I spoke with, and I wanted to center these conversations and the transformative effect that music had on their lives. And in order to do so, I needed to perhaps decenter the institution itself. Of course, that's not to say that music practice is not embroiled in the dynamics, hierarchies, and violence of the institution itself. And I do talk about that in the book. And one of the core arguments is that the study of music practice gives me insight into how these young musicians experience the power of the institution. But it's an intellectual choice that I make to focus on this more ephemeral and fragile force of music practice, rather than on the structure, the larger structural forces, such as the institution.
Thank you. And so, in focusing on what you just said, the ephemeral force of the music, and on the lives of the musicians themselves, you trace this central concept, which brings the book, you know, together, where you develop, theorize, and argue for this idea of enchantment. And I'm going to quote you. You write on page 27 in the introduction that, quote, Enchantment with music appears as both embedded in the rhythms of everyday life and constituting a break, an excess from those rhythms. And you also write that enchantment describes human lives that vibrate in music, as well as the vitality of matter that exceeds the human. So it's like enchantment can be found in the music itself and in the lives of the people, but it also exceeds those things as well. And so I wondered if you could tell us about this concept of enchantment and how it emerged for you as a central theme.
Yes. So enchantment came about as I was listening to how my interlocutors spoke about music, and a phrase that very frequently came up was me encanta, which in Spanish means colloquially, I love it, but also more literally, I'm enchanted by it. So I started thinking about this notion of me encanta, and came to the idea of enchantment. The reason I like this concept is that it contains musical vibrations within itself. So in Spanish, encantar contains cantar, which means to sing. And in English, obviously, it contains chant. So this sonorous dimension of the term was definitely very attractive to me as I chose it for as a central concept of the book. Enchantment describes this sense of fascination that musicians experienced when playing music, the transformative effect that it had on their lives. While I use it to talk specifically about music practice, I hope that it speaks to everyone reading the book, even if their central interest is not music. Enchantment describes the fascination we experience for an activity that we love so much that it changes how we experience time. It affects us physically, changing our heartbeat. Perhaps we experience goosebumps. What is central about how I think about enchantment is that it is usually a collective activity, so taking place in a group, which is in the context of my research is the orchestra, usually. But rather than think about it as a bolt of lightning that strikes us unpredictably, I think about enchantment as rooted in everyday practices and labor, which are oftentimes, a drudgery, struggle, pure discipline, and very uninspiring at times. So music practice is a lot of times about developing skills and technique, which is has to do with a lot of repetition and study, and only rarely in times of perhaps performance, and specifically collective performance, does it lead to enchantment, but this everyday labor is an essential foundation for the possibility of enchantment as fascination and an out of body almost experience to arise. Enchantment is also connected, as you pointed out in the quote from page 27, that it's both embedded in the rhythms of everyday life and also constitutes an excess from those rhythms. What I mean by that is that the sonic energy generated through collective music practices has the capacity to separate us and the musicians from the specific dynamics affecting their everyday lives at that particular moment. It is also a practice that is invested with dreams for the future. And in that sense, enchantment is related to the concept of aspiration. Aspiration as long-term dreams and desires for a different future that are attached to music, and specifically to participation in El Sistema, an internationally renowned music institution, and also aspiration as, if we think about it, as breathing, connecting back to the labor underlying enchantment that they and for wind instruments, aspiration and breathing is literally the embodied labor that goes into learning, practicing, and making an instrument sound.
that's great. It's wonderful. And so you also mentioned earlier you wanted to focus on the transformation in these musicians' lives, and that's why you focus mainly on the, you know, particular musicians in the book. And so I was thinking that when one thinks about the impact of this kind of program, El Sistema, one might again think instantly about like teaching a skill that will enable someone who's like economically impoverished to have better job prospects. So someone might think immediately of like employment, and this is providing them with a means to a better or a profession that will, you know, pay them more money or something like that. However, that may be the case, but also you foreground the transformation and how people think about themselves and their futures. And I was struck by how you mentioned that these instrument lessons offered participants a space to dream and imagine possibilities. And I thought that might not be, you know, immediately considered when someone thinks about inequality. And so what were some of the ways in which you saw El Sistema informing or affecting your participants' lives?
Thank you for this thoughtful question. When I was conducting research on El Sistema, I frequently got questions from colleagues and other friends that try to quantify and measure the impact of music practice on Venezuelan society and in the lives of the musicians themselves. And actually, because El Sistema is also funded by international grants, I could see that language and attempt to quantify music practice there as well. So I got questions such as, has El Sistema reduced poverty in Venezuela, or has El Sistema, in some ways solved socioeconomic inequality or ethno-racial and class discrimination? And the answer potentially to these questions is no, because this program can't be expected to have made such a significant impact, and it does not unfortunately address the root causes of many of these social problems. However, what I found important was that it gave people, and also not every single participant in the program, but just some people, the capacity or the opportunity to see themselves differently and to imagine their futures differently from the future that was dealt to them by virtue of being born on the urban margins in Venezuela. So I saw a transformation in how people could see and imagine themselves. For example, I have one interlocutor, Damien, whose father, when I first met the family, told me that he imagined that his son could be, the oboist in the Berlin Philharmonic. And I found this statement striking because we were on the urban margins in Venezuela, and his son was in a youth orchestra in a Venezuelan city, so quite far away from the possibility of participating in the Berlin Philharmonic. Yet this dream, while obviously a joke to a certain extent, also had a quite serious ring to it. And I started thinking about this. What did it mean that this young person's father could state so boldly that his dream was for his son to be in the Berlin Philharmonic? And what was it about this program that made such dreams not as improbable as they might have been had he not had the opportunity to participate in El Sistema? And so I realized that changing how people thought about themselves and what was possible was a radical interruption of the violence of structural forces that in many ways precluded, limited the life opportunities of my interlocutors. And so I wanted to do justice in my book to these less measurable social transformations that were taking place and were enabling individual people to follow lines of flight away from the urban margins and to pursue futures through immigration in Europe. That said, of course, El Sistema also provided quite literal financial support for the musicians. So that's not anymore the case. But while I was still doing field work, especially for the top El Sistema musicians, the institution provided enviable salaries. So in a country that was undergoing turmoil and inflation, as salaries were being devalued, El Sistema managed to provide its participants, especially in the top orchestras, which admittedly are exclusive spaces just for some musicians. That provided a form of stability that affected not only the individual musician, but also their family as they supported, provided some financial support for their families. And what I found later is that as the Venezuelan currency became devalued, the skill of practicing or being able to play a musical instrument was something that could be transferred to another social context, such as Europe, where many of the El Sistema musicians I worked with ended up, and it was a remunerable skill for them there. So there was a practical dimension, undoubtedly, to participation in El Sistema that especially the parents were of musicians were focused on, as they wanted a stable financial future for their children. But most of my interlocutors who were younger at the time and more idealistic constantly kept bringing me back to the flights of the imagination that were enabled through music and how that imagination affected how they could imagine their or how they could perceive a different future. So that was something that I really wanted to center in my research, and to say that even if we cannot measure the social impact of these processes, that didn't make them any less meaningful and radically transformative of these people's lives. And in terms of the collective effort, El Sistema built communities between in a fragmented and polarized society where communities where there previously was none such community and that would be very improbable given the fragmentation of society. So the mere fact that such communities could take place even for a moment, even if they were not stable entities, or even if they did not address the root causes of inequality and polarization, it enabled a different vision of the future, which also has political potential in and of itself.
And so I think you mentioned this, that El Sistema was supported by the state, by the socialist state in Venezuela. And throughout the book, you maintain or you reference Fernando Coronil. And I bring him up because he was a well-known anthropologist and also a researcher of Venezuela. And he has this idea of the magical state in Venezuela. But I use that also as a way to ask the question of what conclusions that did you find about the role of the state in El Sistema?
So the concept of enchantment, in addition to doing justice to these artistic energies and musical sonorities that are transformative of lives and futures, also explains and illustrates how the power of the Venezuelan state functions. So enchantment is to be able to enchant someone means to have power over them to exercise power over them. And so I think about how the Venezuelan state, which sponsors El Sistema, summoned music, the effective power of music, to affect its audiences and in order to advance its own political aims. So El Sistema orchestras were frequently summoned to perform at large state events. And in those moments, I started thinking about how much music participated in supporting the power of the Venezuelan state. And here's where Fernando Coronil's notion of magic, of state magic, comes into play. Enchantment is, in a way, the enchantment of music is, in a way, an instance of such state magic. So Coronil talks about how the oil-rich Venezuelan state has enabled the leaders of the country to emerge as magnanimous sorcerers that with the enormous oil wealth managed to summon visions of the future, promises of modernity and progress that are spectacular, that enchant their audiences. What is specific about this form of enchantment, of state magic, is that it is very convincing in moments of oil boom. However, once oil prices drop and there is an economic crisis in the country, people suddenly realize that their previous fascination with the state and its promises of progress was actually an illusion. So I started thinking about that process as it took place through enchantment. I asked of my own research, did enchantment meet the same fate as state magic in moments of financial crisis and disillusionment? Did people think of their previous enchantments as false, as an illusion? So I began to investigate this this question. And I realized that even though El Sistema was founded in 1975, a moment of oil boom, it did not collapse together with other similar state projects once the country ran into financial crisis in the 80s and 90s. And this institutional resilience, perhaps we can attribute to the strategic maneuvering of the institution's leader, José Antonio Abreu. But I also think that there's something else to this story. Enchantment is not a simple fascination with a passive fascination with a state and its magic. It is very much invested with the labor and the dreams of musicians who participate in these performances of magic and state magic and enchantment. So I realized that people could not afford to discard their previous enchantments and call them false and an illusion, because they were very much permeated by their dreams, by their labor. And as I spoke to my interlocutors and quite directly asked them whether they found that their previous enchantment was an illusion, even let's say after disappointment with the institution or with the state after political collapse, they almost unanimously answered that no, they did not find that their previous enchantments were an illusion. And in that sense, I find that there's a kind of continuity in enchantment that sheds light on the agentive role of the musicians in these spectacles of state magic. And in studying concerts where the musicians performed for the state under the banners and political slogans of the state, I interviewed musicians afterwards to ask them how they experienced these concerts. And I was wondering, did they simply think of music as completely subjected to the aims of the state, and they usually answered no, that these musical experiences were quite varied and had more to do with the beauty of the music being played or the collective energy that was being generated. And this energy generated an excess, went beyond the aims and intentions of the state. And that's something that I learned from the concept of enchantment and something that it allowed me to hold a space for in my writing.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So this question kind of goes to the, I guess, the writing of the book, or, you know, the thought processes in constructing your arguments in the book, because you have this discussion of musical vitalities, and in the book, you kind of make visible the work of applying theory to different cases. And so, for example, you have this in this one chapter, you move between kind of theories of Marxism and theories of new materialism, and you articulate the stakes of using one theory over the other. And so, for example, Marx's theory, if you use Marx's theory, it might posit that the music that you're talking about in El Sistema blinds people to the problems that undergird their everyday lives. However, if you use the new materialism theory, this opens up and enables you to closely describe the role of music in your participants' lives. But you include that in the text, like the stakes of choosing or using one theory over another. And I thought that was really interesting, because many times, as writers and anthropologists, we make our theoretical decisions, we pick our theories in a way, and then we go with it. But you kind of provide this backstage thinking into the implications of using one theory over another. And so I wondered, why was it important for you to stage this movement between one theory and another, and, you know, and articulate the stakes between making these choices?
Thank you for this question. When I was in doing my fieldwork in Venezuela, I would speak to the musicians and ask them how they would describe music. And many times they would say that speak of music and magic in the same breath. They would tell me that music is magical. It has such power over people's lives. It has transformed them and their ideas for the future. They also spoke of music as going beyond words, as musical experience having such deep emotional impact on them that it was hard to translate that experience into words. And I, as someone who had similar experiences with music, as a very young anthropologist myself, in my first forays of fieldwork, I took these statements seriously, and I went back to my graduate program, and in conversations with mentors, I tried to share these ideas about music as magic. And I was told that I could not believe in that magic myself as a serious researcher. I could think about why people might come to think of music as magical. I could also not literally believe that the music was beyond words, because linguistic anthropology teaches us that as people born in linguistically mediated environments, there is no such experience as beyond words. Everything, even those experiences, are in some ways mediated by words. Specifically in thinking about music as magical, I was told rightly by my mentors that if we think about Karl Marx's notion of commodity fetishism, thinking of music as an independent agent would obscure relationships of exploitation that underlie these processes of the aliveness, supposed aliveness of music. So, in being stimulated to analyze my interlocutors' words from a distance and refract them through a theoretical framework, I felt uncomfortable because I realized that it was a kind of condescending attitude towards my interlocutors' words for me to be the one who saw more clearly the relations of exploitation in which they themselves were immersed. And as I was searching for ways to do more justice to their description of music as magical, I came to theories of new materialism, a strand in philosophy that thinks about the vitality and agency of matter that exceeds the human. And I found that this theory came very, very close to how my interlocutors themselves theorized music and their relationship to it. They many times spoke of their instruments as their best friends, as romantic partners, and music, obviously, as a physical phenomenon of vibration that involves the musician, the human agent, the instrument that vibrates when being played, but also the instrument is imposing limitations and unexpected events on the musical phenomenon. So a violin string can break, the oboe reed might not sound. So sometimes musical instruments were recalcitrant, a kind of agency of matter. But describing my own transition from my own struggles to find a theory to do justice to my interlocutor's words also illuminates a conviction that I have and have developed with my colleague Laura McTighe, who talks about theory on the ground. So theory that's built from conversations on the ground with people, theory that's built in collaboration with our interlocutors, rather than a theory that is subject to the refinement of the raw material of fieldwork in the ivory tower of the academy. So I'm similarly committed to thinking about fieldwork experiences as sites where theory is built, where concepts are born, and it's always a process that takes place in collaboration with our interlocutors, as learning from their expertise and their own forms of theorizing that they do on an everyday basis in relation to their own life experiences.
Thank you. So this is another question about writing the book as well. And you take this particular approach to writing the book. I was thinking about it. I was like, maybe I would call it experimental ethnographic writing. And I say this because it reminded me of when I was in college, which was in the late 90s. I remember professors talking about the crisis of representation in anthropology, and they would assign these different ethnographies that were playing with different modes of presenting material. And so some of these ethnographies, for example, might have been written like in the first person, or, you know, they were just playing with writing and genre. And so that's what made me, you know, kind of what made me think about your book, because you you present the work in a very creative way. Your book has 20 short chapters, and it's divided across four sections in the book. And so, you know, typically a book might have, I don't know, five or six chapters, and however you break the material up into these shorter chapters and across these different sections. And when you're writing the book or in your narrative of the book, you maintain a presence in the narrative very consistently through your interactions and with your participants, as well as your engagement with other scholars. And so I just wondered, what are your thoughts about ethnographic writing, and how did you come to develop this form and style that you present in the book?
Thank you. So as I started writing the book, I had the privilege of doing this 3-year postdoc at the Society of Fellows at Dartmouth College. And I had a lot of time on my hands, even as I was facing the precarity of the academic job market. But I was also lucky in that I found at Dartmouth several mentors, such as Sienna Craig, who writes ethnographic fiction in addition to more traditionally recognizable forms of ethnography, Ted Levin, an ethnomusicologist, and Will Chang, who's also the series editor of my book. And through engagement with these scholars, who gave me the encouragement, but also the power to believe in the process of looking for my own ethnographic voice, I began searching for the genre or the structure that would make the most sense given the ethnographic material that I had. So I participated in several ethnographic writing workshops where anthropologists such as Katie Stewart and Paul Stoller encouraged us, all of the participants, to experiment with writing style, to write shorter 500-word segments of ethnographic writing, to use multisensory ethnography, to focus on evoking the feel of a place, of people. And so I took a lot of pleasure in that type of writing. It gave me so much more freedom than when I was trying to write an academic article for a flagship journal, for example. And I tried to hold on to that feeling of free writing that I enjoyed in these ethnographic writing workshops. And so I started writing from a memory, from a feeling, and I started developing these stories that I understood are important to include in the book. But every time I tried to discipline these stories into the five chapters of a standard academic book, they exercised a kind of resistance. They could never quite fit. And if I tried to make them fit, I felt like I was taking away some of their vitality. I was clipping away some of their shape and breath. So I wrote shorter segments that became these 20 chapters that ultimately formed the book. I remember reading that Julio Cortázar, the Argentine novelist, in writing his book Rayuela, which similarly has dozens of chapters, shorter chapters, he printed out all of, or rather, had all of his chapters on the floor of his apartment, and he was walking around trying to figure out how to order them. And in his book, you can read the chapters in two different ways, either in the order in which they appear or a different order that the author provides. So I followed that example, and I printed out my 20 draft chapters, put them on the floor, and then walked around trying to figure out in what order I wanted them to appear. So the chapters don't necessarily follow from one another. Many times they do, but sometimes they're more free-floating units that connect to the major sections that they appear under. But I try to do less signposting and more delicate, you know, threads to weave these chapters together. In terms of my own position, I've tried to make it very transparent, and I'm inspired by the writing culture movement that you reference, Reagan. In the history of anthropology, it has always been important to demonstrate the distance or proximity that an anthropologist has to their research site. So I needed to make that clear. And also everything that I experienced, everything that became part of my research was refracted through my own being, through my own history as a child of the revolutions in Bulgaria. So I needed that story to be also a part of the book as well, because it became an important factor in how people saw me and how I interacted with my interlocutors and the friendships I built. So it is a very personal account with which I aim to be as transparent as possible about my process and my writing.
Yeah, that's great. I think that the book was really a wonderful read. I really enjoyed reading it. And I think that, you know, people who are listening will also enjoy reading it for those very reasons that you mentioned, the structure and the transparency that you provide, and also the stories, of course, from the people, from your interlocutors in the book, made it really, it was really interesting to read and to follow through the storylines.
Thank you.
And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the ethnographic fieldwork process that you undertook for the book. It seems like, and you talked about this a little bit, your own musical background helped to facilitate your knowledge of music, of the music that the students were learning. And I think you even taught some lessons in El Sistema. But also a running theme throughout the book is the violence of the city. And you mentioned the disintegration of the state. And so what were the challenges and highlights of carrying out this field work in Venezuela?
Thank you for this question. It brings me back to my first, trips to Venezuela. I was, I guess, in many ways terrified at the time, because the moment I informed my friends and relatives that I was going to Venezuela, everybody told me that I'm crazy because it has the reputation for being a very violent country, kidnappings, homicides, et cetera, et cetera. So every trip to Venezuela was a sort of exercise in willpower, willpower very much aided by that feeling that I referred to in the beginning of our conversation, that unstoppable a conviction that that is rare for me, and that moved me to do my research in Venezuela. I very much was supported at every single stage of this research by the care and protection of people I met on the ground, by my interlocutors who taught me how to become a savvy pedestrian in a crime-ridden city, who offered me protection by frequently walking me to my subway and checking in later by text whether I got home. So I, on the one hand, feared the violence in the city, and I was robbed a few times, but also precisely because of the precariousness of the Venezuelan context at the time of my fieldwork, I also enjoyed incredible generosity and care from my interlocutors. And this has been an important part of my fieldwork and perhaps what led to the consolidation of friendships with my interlocutors that are alive to this very day and are as significant as any other ones I have made in my life. As you mentioned, my ability to play music together with my interlocutors was also really important, precisely for the reason that I discussed earlier, that musicians would say that we couldn't only talk about music, I had to play it together with them in order to understand what they're talking about. So my ability to play, even as I wasn't quite as good as they were, it enabled that shared experience of temporality that takes place in the moment of playing music together, that collaboration between the accompaniment I provided and their solo performances. In the case of teaching music, it was my opportunity to give back to the community some of the generosity I had received from them. So. And in terms of the violence, I guess I keep coming back to that question recently. And when I was younger and doing my research there, I was constantly afraid and thought that I, am in a very vulnerable position, which perhaps I was. But in reality, everyday violence affects the most young men of color on the urban margins, who are the victims and perpetrators of this violence. And it affects less, privileged researchers such as myself. So I have put less of an emphasis more recently in thinking about my own vulnerability and, of course, emphasizing the fact that I always had a way to leave the country in the moment if such political turmoil occurred that it wouldn't be unsafe for me to be there anymore, and that I enjoyed the protection of my status, and also I never lived in the barrios themselves. I decided that this was too much of a risk for me at the time, even though I spent lots of time there, and I spent weekends sometimes with my interlocutors' families. I, for the most part, lived in a middle class neighborhood of Caracas, which provided relative stability for me in this context as I was doing research on my own.
So this is the last question, I guess, about the book, and it really takes us to the end of the book, where many of your interlocutors end up in Europe after the Venezuelan state and society experience quite a bit of turmoil and disintegration. And so I just wondered, has El Sistema managed to continue in the face of these current troubles facing Venezuela? And I also wondered, in light of this, this current situation, does that increase the stakes of writing about this kind of program when you did? I thought in a way your ethnography captures, the spirit of this program, at this particular time. And that's not to say that the spirit doesn't continue, but I thought in light of what's going on, it might increase the stakes of writing about these kinds of interventions.
Thank you. Yes, it's been very hard to witness from a distance the collapse of Venezuela currently taking place. So there's a humanitarian crisis very much exacerbated by the COVID pandemic. In a moment when people are struggling to find food and basic care, it's hard to imagine the functioning of a classical music program. El Sistema still exists. I haven't been in Venezuela for a long time, but the interlocutors who are still there tell me about events taking place while once El Sistema provided enviable salaries, nowadays it provides salaries that are not enough for covering people's basic needs, and it has been very much subsumed under the state. If previously it enjoyed some kind of institutional distance from the state, that distance has almost completely been eliminated. And most of the interlocutors I worked with have immigrated to Europe, which is unusual for the migration patterns out of Venezuela that usually take people to other Latin American countries. In the case of El Sistema musicians, many of them end up in Europe and specifically Paris. The stakes of writing about these live projects that flourish in the midst of crisis are perhaps contained in the question, what is lost in the telling of a story of a collapsing political system? So if I chose to speak exclusively of the collapse of El Sistema as an institution or its basically decline, or if I chose to write exclusively about the failure of the socialist political project in Venezuela and its resulting humanitarian crisis, I would miss the stories of my interlocutors that are stories of lives just beginning, futures unfolding. And for me, it's important to hold on to these stories and make space for them in my writing. And the conclusion of the book is dedicated to tracing the life paths of my interlocutors as they're separated from their parents who remain in Venezuela, who send remittances back home and support their parents. I think in terms of the stakes, I obviously recognize that there is a point in which talking about music practice is impossible when life itself is threatened and on the line, as is the case right now. But as one of my interlocutors who remains in Venezuela is, as far as I know, the only woman to found and be the director of a music school, reports to me, it's important for her to be able to engage in music practice to the extent possible and to share that with students who are still interested. And she talks about how it's impossible to ask people anymore for financial support to buy cement for the music school when people don't have enough to eat. But nevertheless, she continues to provide music lessons and in addition to that, meals for students who might be hungry. And so she's an illustration of for me of the importance of beauty, of artistic practice, even for people who struggle to survive and are faced with such brutal violence and political collapse.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. So we tend to end the interviews with the question about what you have on the horizon. And so now that Sonorous Worlds is out into the world, do you have any projects that you're working on now, or are you planning on, do you have any projects that you're planning on for the future?
Yes, thanks for this question. My second book project is called The Politics of Joy, Collective Art Practices Across American Borders. And in this project, I'm interested in exploring how first and second generation Latinx women, queer people and queer and trans people and envision political activism as practices of joy, pleasure, self-care, healing, and female solidarity that's frequently expressed through art. I'm focusing on grassroots artists, such as musicians, specifically the genre of son jarocho that originates in Mexico, but is also performed in the US and beyond. I focus on poets, nail artists, most of them based in LA, but also across borders. So it's a multi-sided project with some research that will take place in Veracruz, Mexico, in LA, and perhaps in Toronto. So I'm interested in how people summon art to voice their right to exist and even flourish in oppressive contexts. And this fieldwork has been interrupted by the pandemic. I've had to focus almost exclusively on social media research through Instagram and Twitter, but I'm hoping to recommence it this summer.
Well, that is fascinating, and wishing you the best on your, you know, continuing that kind of that research. So thank you so much. I've been speaking with Dr. Yana Steinova, the author of Sonorous Worlds, Musical Enchantment in Venezuela, published by the University of Michigan Press. Thank you so much for writing this book and for sharing it with us here on the podcast.
Thank you so much for the invitation and the thoughtful questions, Reagan.